Please pray with me. Dearest God, in these moments of exposure to your loving forgiveness, teach us to stop counting, stop fixing, and to stop saving our own faces. And somehow, O God, may the words of my mouth and the meditations of all of our hearts be acceptable in your sight, O God, our rock and our redeemer. Amen. Which one are you in this story? What kind of debts or trespasses or sins hang you up? How many times do we miscount our own ledgers? One of my educational regrets is that I never took an accounting class. I had no idea how much I would need that knowledge as a pastor. What would I need an accounting class for? I thought I was entering into the forgiveness business. You know, the work of declaring that God keeps no ledgers. And this is where our text begins. Counting. Peter asked Jesus in the usual Jewish dialogue style, "What does the ledger of forgiveness look like? What sins are forgivable? And how many times are we required to forgive?" And in reality, isn't this how we assess everything in our lives? We calculate who has wronged us, what kind of misdeed is this, and then we, like Peter, are ready with the check marks. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, really? How many times? And then Jesus answers, 77 times? The actual number? No. Jesus means all the numbers, all the time. And then comes the story, which is usually our favorite part, right? The story, we like the story better than the do this, do that, and don't do that. But look at this story. Even though the writer of Matthew turns this into an allegory, it appears to the scholars that Jesus is just telling a story. The Gentile king is owed 10,000 bags of gold. I don't care how small that bag is. We're talking about a lot of money, right? And only a Gentile in Jesus' day would order the servant and his family to be sold. Which, think about it. In reality, how is that going to pay the debt, right? 10,000 bags of gold. But the servant begs from the floor with this ridiculous plea to the king about the state of the ledger. "Be patient with me, and I will repay you." Are you kidding? By any standard, it's a huge, unpayable debt. That's the point. This debt cannot be paid. So what is the servant saying by pretending that he can pay it back? Isn't he really saying, "I don't need forgiveness. I'm a self-made man"? But the next line in the text says, "The master had compassion on that servant, released him, and forgave the loan." But the servant, who was forgiven much, is delusional. He still thinks he can pay his debt. He can make it right. He doesn't need forgiveness, ultimately, because he will earn back his credibility, his credit to the good side of the ledger. So with this mistaken idea that he can't earn and fix and repay and patch up his debt, he begins the process of acquiring payments. So he searches out someone who owes him. And he is ruthless over a little bitty prison. This is our human nature, isn't it? To deny our vulnerability, to turn away from the humiliating reality that we need to be forgiven in this life? Did the servant who was forgiven for an unpayable debt forget? Or is it more plausible that he has rationalized that exchange? He ignores the forgiveness. Why? Because he's mortified. Mortified, embarrassed, humbled, limited, mortal. To be mortal is to be subject to death. To be mortified is to be reminded that we are mortal, limited, fallible, subject to imperfection, disease, and death. And heaven knows we are death-defying as a culture. We want to stay young, stay strong. Never let them see you sweat. Take your punishment like a man. We would prefer punishment to forgiveness. And then we run into Jesus, who tells us that forgiveness heals as much as pick up your mat and walk. Jesus, who says, the first will be last. Which one are you in the story? What kind of debts, trespasses, or sins hang you up? How many times do we miscount our own ledgers and nail others to mortal fallibility? What else is going on with the servant who is forgiven much? Is there anything going on besides his frenetic and absurd desire to repay his impossible debt? Well, how do we save face in our mirrors or ledgers when we have been confronted with our inability to measure up? Well, human nature says, let's look for someone who doesn't measure up even to us. We point a finger. We play the devil's advocate. We shine the light away from ourselves. Sometimes I think we are so busy saving face, creating a face, denying our own faces that we don't recognize ourselves as being worthy of, needing, or deserving of forgiveness. Brené Brown, a data-driven researcher on shame, has a whole lecture series on the concept of doing the best they can. Frustrated by the irritations of life, the lack of perfection in others, she asks her friends, trusted colleagues, even strangers, "Do you really think that people are doing the best they can?" And the cosmic answer comes back, "Yes." Every time I lose my cool with a driver who swerves out of their lane and into mine, or a friend who doesn't answer my phone call, I remember Brené's wisdom. People are doing the best they can. When my mom died in 2011, I took my jolly good time in forgiving her. Not for dying, but for living in such a way that simply wore out my father and wore me out. I got there, finally, because I realized even she was doing the best she could. I have to accept that I am forgiven every day. I am mortal, limited, I'm doing the best I can, and the best I can do isn't enough to deal with my 10,000 bags of gold debt. And you know what? Yelling at someone else isn't really going to save my own face. Which one are you in the story? What kind of debts, trespasses or sins hang you up? How many times do we miscount our own ledgers and magnify someone else's? Now, friends, about that scary ending of the parable, the biblical experts think that this was tacked on. And frankly, it seems less like Jesus to end a story of forgiveness with eternal punishment. Jesus was about forgiveness. Now, I have to tell you that when Liz sent me the children's time earlier this week, I had to chuckle a little bit. Because when I was about 10 years old, I hit a softball through the neighbor's garage window. That's when I learned how to take out a window, how to nail in a new one. Really, you have to nail in a piece of glass. Did you know that? Without breaking it. How to putty, how to paint the frame. Of course, that was after measuring, taking a trip down to the hardware store. Putz Hardware is still there on Salzburg Avenue in Bay City. But was I forgiven? Yes, I was forgiven. I learned something in the process. But this error of mine, like most of what we heard in children's time, is fixable. Bats can be replaced, windows can be replaced, lamps can be fixed. Not sure about the Van Gogh piece of art in the children's time. But ultimately, you can pay the debt. It's fixable, it's doable. But real forgiveness is when something cannot be excused, repaid, fixed, or changed. Real forgiveness is what happens when the words cannot be taken back, when the life cannot be returned, when the childhood cannot be altered, the scars removed, brain damage undone, the ledger cannot be balanced. I am determined to find forgiveness that heals, the Jesus kind. And as many of you know, I'm still recovering from what some call worm theology, the depraved humanity concept that we are all worms and that the love of Christ saves us in spite of that fact. Of late, to help me with my own perspective on forgiveness, I'm listening to Father Gregory Boyle. He's the Catholic priest who serves returning citizens. That's what he calls people who have finished their prison term, returning citizens. You might know him better by the name of his ministry called Homeboy Industries. He helps young people get out of gangs and build a life. But most of all, what he offers to these young people is a God who is so loving and so forgiving, they find healing for wounds that we cannot even imagine. He tells the story of taking one of the former gang members who grew up in that Los Angeles neighborhood to speak, to tell a little bit of his story. And he says, I grew up going to school with three t-shirts on because my mother beat me every day. I put one t-shirt on to soak up the blood. I put a second t-shirt on to cover up the blood that's soaking through the first t-shirt. I put the third t-shirt on so, you know, I'd look clean. He says, now I look at those scars and I love them. And I let myself see them. And this kid with barely any education says, I have to be able to see my wounds and love them so I can help to see other people's wounds and love them. When we keep a ledger, judging ourselves and seeking to measure up, we miss the point. Father Greg says, when we are judging, we are taking up the room we need for loving. I don't know about you, but I have too much room wasted on judgment. That ledger that screams to be balanced. Because I know, even on my most perfect day of doing the best I can, my ledger is unbalanced. And I have to accept that forgiveness is what I need to breathe, like oxygen. That it's not some kind of rest stop on the journey of life. Forgiveness is not balancing the ledger. Listen to the story of Jesus. The ledger is thrown away. The book I'm reading is called Barking to the Choir. He says, I don't believe that contemporary culture is hostile to God. He says, people are just pretty good at sniffing out the phony. But he says, we in the church choir, that's us, whether or not you were singing up here, we're all the church choir. We, the church choir, the lovers of God, we still need to learn how to accept our own necessary forgiveness. And maybe, just maybe, if we can accept the forgiveness of God, we can stop judging others and stop giving people the wrong idea about what church is all about. Which one are you in the story? What kind of debts, trespasses, or sins hang you up? How many of our ledgers would Jesus like to destroy so that knowing we are forgiven, we might get better at forgiving and loving others? Amen.